Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome.
Welcome back to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas. Our guest today is Dave Cullen, who is a New York Times best-selling author for both of his books, Columbine and Parkland. If you don't know, Columbine is one of my all-time favorite books, so I am beyond thrilled to have Dave on the show today. But before we dive into that conversation, I wanted to remind you all that in the show notes, you can find everything we've talked about on today's episode. So if a book sounds interesting or we mention an actor you're not familiar with, you can click that link and go find yourself that book or learn more about the author or whatever else it is that you're interested in. You can also find links to all of our social media accounts and more in the show notes. To get inside access to The Stacks and help support the work we're doing here, consider joining us over on Patreon. That's where you can be a part of The Stacks Pack and find our video book club where other lovers of this show chat with me about The Stacks book club picks. There are other fun perks over there too, so go to patreon.com/thestacks to check it out. We're partnered with Audible, an online database of hundreds of thousands of audiobooks, to get you a free audiobook and a free 30-day trial. All you have to do to redeem is be a listener of The Stacks and head to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts and that you leave us a rating and a review. I know I ask you to do this every week. Trust me, I wouldn't ask if it didn't help spread the word about the show. So, if you haven't done so yet, please take a moment to rate and review this show. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Also, if you're in the market for a book recommendation, let us help you. Email askingthestacks@gmail.com and we could give you a personalized on-air suggestion from myself and one of our guests. Just send us your name and what it is you're looking for in a book. Be sure to include a few books you've loved or hated so we can find you the perfect match. Email us at askingthestacks@gmail.com. Okay, now it's time for you all to hear my conversation with author Dave Cullen. All right, everybody, I am here today with author and journalist Dave Cullen. Dave is the author of New York Times bestseller Columbine and, most recently, New York Times bestseller Parkland, Birth of a Movement. Dave's work can be found also in the publications including The New York Times, Slate, The Daily Beast, and you may have seen Dave on television on CBS This Morning, Rachel Maddow, and a whole lot more. So Dave, welcome to The Stacks.
Thanks. It's great for being here. Oh, by the way, and my website, DaveCullen.com, you can find all
DaveCullen.com. We're going to link to all his social media in the show notes. You guys know the drill. So I have to just say this now. I have to get out of my system officially. As many of you know, Dave Cullen is one of my favorite authors. And this is a really important day in my life because I have an actual physical list of authors that I wanted to have on the podcast, and you're the first one on my list.
So this
is huge for me personally and a little bit embarrassing because I'm like fangirling, but it's okay. We're going to talk about you.
I never get tired of that. You know, and like I used to really have a really hard time, by the way, with like up and through Columbine. I had like a really hard time with compliments and I would always get so embarrassed. And I talked to my editor about it. John Karp, who's now running Simon & Schuster, he's brilliant. And he's like, just take the compliment.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, like, he's like, just say thank you. And like, and, but you know what? But, and mean it. And now I was like, oh, okay, it's okay. But like, yeah, I'm like, now I'm just like happy. Like, okay, that's good. It's
yeah.
Like, instead of like, why, you know, do the whole like, you know, my Catholic guilt thing. That's like, right. Oh, I'm not worthy. Like, okay, but thanks. So anyway, I love being here.
Well, good. I'm so glad. We'll stop with the compliments for a little bit. I might compliment you again. I'm going to try not to. Also, I don't compliment very easily, so just so you know. Okay, so I want to start kind of where I've listened to you on a lot of things. I've read your stuff, but I don't actually know a ton about your origin story.
Let's
rewind a little bit. Where do you come from? How did you become a journalist? How did this happen?
Okay. Well, yeah, I usually don't talk about it. Okay. So like Midwestern Catholic boy, suburbs of Chicago, 9 kids,
wow.
Dreaded middle child. yeah. In the 60s, a very Republican, oh God, household and district and like really, you know, really tense upbringing with, you know, nuns. And also, you know what? In gay and not knowing it, which had such an impact on my life of like, I mean, I was like bullied pretty badly and didn't know why I was different. You know, the whole thing, like, I knew it was I was different and didn't know why. I felt like it was an alien planet from an alien planet and just didn't fit in. But, like, a really fun kid. But I kept going back. of when I started writing. Because like in fourth grade, there were different projects we could do. And I chose the one with just like a handful of people who picked up like writing a little storybook for the first graders. Mm. And I ended up writing almost half the book because I just like started churning them out. And one of them was called Movie Star Mouse. I can't remember. They were all sort of like little nutso things. And I kept thinking like that was the first time I sort of expressed it. But it was only later I realized I really started writing when I was like five. Hmm. I'm not sure how old. So my older brother and I, we would lie in bed when my parents would send us to bed early so they could like have a little quiet time with nine freaking kids. It was a freaking zoo.
I bet.
Four bedrooms. I mean, just anyway. So we would lie in bed and every night we would do another little chapter or kind of scene in this ongoing, it was sort of a cross between a novel and a soap opera.
Okay.
But it was like these cowboys, it was on a ranch, we had characters, we'd even rewrite scenes. Like we would get, sometimes we'd get the next night and we'd decide like, oh, I didn't like that thing last night. We didn't call them scenes, but they were scenes.
Right.
And I'm like, so we'd like redo it. We'd back up and redo it. And it was this ongoing thing. And I only get now, I was like, oh my God, we're freaking writing a book together. We're collaborating. So he's my first collaborator.
Does he write?
No. He's a, well, in a way, I mean, it's embedded in different careers. He's a prosecutor.
Okay.
So like, that's a version of storytelling
too, for sure. Totally.
And you know, and when I see him doing his opening statements and his closing, actually, do you know the Quan McDonald trial in Chicago? Mm-hmm. First a cop in a generation, maybe ever,
yes.
Convicted of murder, of killing.
Yeah.
So that was taken away from Chicago because right. the whole thing with Rahm Emanuel and given to a special prosecutor in the suburbs. He was one of the special prosecutors.
Wow.
He was one of the three people on the team. He did a lot of the cross-examinations.
Wow. And I've heard his case. Voice then because there was a great podcast.
12 shots or
16 13? Shots.
Sorry,
yeah. Yeah.
Sorry.
But it's okay. 16 shots. But I've heard his voice then. Wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. While I was writing Parkland and some big things happening and covering the kids, I was like the second most in my family. I was sort of like,
yeah.
The number two person of something
that's
going
right.
on.
But two of nine is still pretty good. Like you weren't nine of nine.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that was quite a thing. Everybody was watching like the trial live and a lot of them went to the trial. But yeah, so I mean, yeah, I get an interesting feeling. I mean, we have like some pioneers, like two of my sisters are airplane pilots.
Wow.
Yeah, one of them for United. She's retired now, with raising her kids. One of them for Southwest.
Wow.
And yeah, and with women, when it was really rare for
right.
women to do that.
Right.
Yeah, so like, yeah, I mean, my dad especially did kind of instill in us just like, sort of like, do anything you want. You know, I can go back further. almost half of my family's accountants.
Okay.
And like, and even my extended family, there's a lot of accountants and lawyers. And there's like, there's not a single other creative person of like, God, I have like 40 cousins. I don't think there's a single person who does anything creative. And I used to wonder, it's like, am I wrong? Is this like in my blood? You know, it's like, or is, you know, is it just me doing this? Or am I sort of like nuts that this is really my calling? And I really have doubts about that because like you do see things. So it wasn't actually... I found out, like, I think in my 30s, maybe it was when I was a businessman, too, and I did the Army and lots of other stuff, and I dropped out of college.
Wait, you were in the Army?
I dropped out of college to enlist in the infantry.
This yeah. makes more sense yeah. to me all of a sudden. Okay.
Yeah, and then I went to officer candidate school. Yeah, they asked me to go to officer candidate school and become an officer, but then I broke my back and had to leave. So I lived in Walter Reed for 6 months.
Wow.
In D.C., yeah. In the Arthur Ward, the famous... So it was all double and triple amputees and me in
and
a
you.
Body cast.
Did you break your back, like, in... Like, or did you have,
not
like, a weird accident?
No,
like, you
after,
fell off a horse
a
or something?
Party. It was,
okay.
It was, yeah, it was climbing a tree, actually.
Oh, my God.
Yes, I know. Yeah, I'm
it's
like,
okay.
I was talking to one of my friends, like, yeah, I know, it's a terrible story. And she's like... One of my friends is like, I think that's a great story.
Well, you got to think, like, if you had broken your back and you weren't in the Army, it would be a really great story. But because it was the Army, people are like, wait, what were you doing climbing
a
tree?
I know.
But anywhere else, it would be like, oh, my God, he broke his back. Like, what? Okay, so I do have...
Yeah, it's far afield. But yeah,
we'll
come back to it.
We go nuts all the time. Okay, so here's my question. Before Columbine happens, let's say March 1999. You're a journalist. Did you think you'd be an author? Did you have a book you wanted to write before this kind of happened in the world and you heard the call?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of the other way around.
Okay.
So, but I will back up a little. So I became a businessman. I worked for Arthur Andersen and Ross Perot's company, EDS.
Oh my God.
Because after I broke my back, I decided, I got what they rated me like a 23% chance or something that I would become paralyzed because I still have bone fragments in my spinal canal. I decided I had to do something where I wouldn't be a drain on society. And so I had to do something sensible. So I got my math and computer science undergrad degree.
Okay.
So that's my undergrad. And I went back to college, finished, and then became a computer guy and then a management consultant and went to Kuwait after the Gulf War for 2 years. And that's where I built my freedom fund to go back and quit all that and go to grad school in my 30s to study creative writing and to be a novelist.
Okay.
And then while I was there, one of my profs is like, basically, the short story is like, you're really good at this essays. Have you thought about doing this? And I was like, essays? Ugh. And he's like, you idiot. Like, you don't get what an essay is. It's like, so, you know, it's not the narrow thing you think. So he had me try it. He's like, just write a scene tonight. And I did. He's like, this is good. Now write the book. So I was working on a memoir, and I used my memoir as my, you know, about coming back from Kuwait as my master's thesis. And so I finished the program, and I was working on finishing the rewriting the that and looking for a publisher and decided I should start building a platform. I don't think we had that word then back in 1999, but the idea. And by the way, I had done journalism in college, like almost 20 years before.
Okay.
And a ton where I interviewed George Bush Sr. when I was 19.
Oh my God.
About a week before he was elected vice president, I interviewed Bono and The Edge after the first U2 album. And like I did like 300 stories. I was like a political, you know, reporter. And anyway, so I loved doing that, but I got really burned out on journalism. And I thought I got burned out on writing was the thing. And here's really a message to other writers out there. I had gotten so into this niche of daily journalism and doing that as because there was a way to do it. It was like a college paper. And then I got burned out on it. And I thought, and so I knew, okay, this isn't for me. And so I thought like, okay, I was wrong. Writing isn't for me. No, what I didn't get is like that form, daily short form journalism.
That
isn't it. I like both journalism and especially writing and the creative part of it. And I had no like outlet for it. There's no room for creativity, you know, an 800 word.
This is what happened.
In an hour. Yeah. So I just sort of like allowed my creative world to be narrowly defined down as all our lives tend to happen. And then decided I didn't like it and didn't realize, well, back up you know, to what you originally were. Oh, by the way, the one thing that I forgot to, I found out later, my dad wanted, I'm going to go back for 1 second. My dad wanted to be a writer when he was in college, and he wrote for his high school and college papers. He wrote for a real Chicago paper while in high school.
As wow.
But then decided he couldn't do it. Then I found out my grandfather also, he got a scholarship as this, you know, poor Irish guy. But like, he was a great writer and a poet when he was like 14.
Wow.
And then my aunt, you know, showed me his like poems from when he was like 14. His grandfather published a revolutionary paper in Chicago, basically before the IRA in the 1800s, and was involved in this invasion of Irish American invasion of Canada, just after the Civil War, fomenting it. And
so, which, like, writing is in your paternal line.
It's totally in my blood. And I was like, oh, I had no, I thought I was the only one. Like, this was whole history of people.
Wow.
And since him, who have not sort of succeeded as writers,
right?
And not sort of like gone there, given up and not thought they could,
right?
And I have like 100 years of writers trying, 150 years of writers trying to make it happen. So I felt better, like, oh, I'm finally getting there. Of like, anyway. So going back, so then back to the 1999, again, I had given up journalism like almost 20 years before, but kept getting pulled back to writing and creative writing. And that's why I went to the writing program. So then in 1999, I hadn't done a journalism story in almost 20 years until April 1999, about maybe 2 years before. And I got an op-ed published, was my first piece. And talked to Salon, which was a hot web magazine then, and talked to Joan Walsh, who was the brand new news editor that went on to become editor-in-chief, and she's wonderful. It was about the Matthew Shepard trial.
Of course.
And so I talked to her, and she's like, oh, I was going to – I like that. I was going to run it. I was going to pair it with a reported news piece, but then I never got around to assigning it. And I thought – And then there was this pause, and I'm like, is this supposed to go, like, you know, be the go-getter guy? I'm like, I can do that for you, ma'am.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, that's too corny. I just can't. I can't. And then silence, and like, the answer is yes, that is what she was hoping for. And it was a test, and I failed the test by saying nothing. But she decided to bail me out anyway and goes, you live out there, because I was in Denver. Like, would you want to cover it for me? And I'm like, oh my God, yeah. So I covered that on no notice, just drove out there. And I'm like, you know, New York Times and everybody had been there.
What year was that?
1999. It was like 2 weeks before Columbine. And so I went out to cover the trial for them. And my journalism friends were like, I'm like, how am I going to do a story the first day? And my friend, actually, Kevin Davis, is a great author, look him up, said, it'll come right back to you. Just look around. In 20 minutes, you'll have a bunch of story ideas. And I'm thinking, like, no, I won't. I got there. I did. There was like stories everywhere. Oh. So I did that story. But then it was the first trial. And Russell Henderson, he pled out. So the whole thing was just that day. So I got one story out of it instead of several. And then I'm thinking, like, okay, how am I going to do another story? But because of that, I had done it again, and I had an editor to turn to. So Columbine happened. I was in Denver. I sat down for lunch with my budget gourmet entree, beef stroganoff. I was just starting to eat, watching the local news about a quarter to noon, and it just came on. There were reports of shots fired at a high school. No injuries. So I thought it was probably nothing. So I called and left an apologetic voicemail to Joan saying, it's probably nothing. There's a school shooting outside of Denver. I'm going to go out there just in case. And I just got in the car and went. And that's also sort of like my number one thing to, not just journalists, but like, I think kind of everybody in any field.
Right.
Just sort of like, if there's a thing, if there's a moment, like a door opening that seems like nothing and probably stupid and like, you can't, like, just freaking get in your car and go.
Right.
You know, Woody Allen said, I think, you know, 99% of life is showing up. And like, it so is.
It's right.
Like, I mean, obviously, then you have to do the work, you have to be good at what you are, blah, blah, blah. But like, you got to get there. Like,
right.
None of that talent does you anything unless you get in your freaking car and you just show. I had no idea where Columbine was. I'd never heard of it.
Right.
I drove out toward the mountains and outside my, I was going to, that's what journalists do. You just fumble your way toward it.
Right.
Stop at a gas station or whatever, or a series of them, you know. I saw a helicopter circling out the window to my left. And that's when my stomach clenched into my first realization. This is something horrible's happening down there. And then I drove toward the helicopters.
Wow. So
that's how it started for me. And I had no idea. Obviously, 20 years later, I'll be sitting across the table with
still
you.
Still talking about it. I know.
And so many, by the way, I think 4 or 5 different times in my life, I've said and totally meant it, like, okay, thank God I'm done with that. I'm never, you know, writing about Columbine again. I'm done with that part of my career.
Right.
And meant it and thought, you know, it keeps just pulling me back. But I had no idea, like, this is where this would take me. But
sure. Well, how could you know?
You never know.
How would you know? There's no way. I mean, it wasn't, there had been obviously mass shootings before, but there was nothing like Columbine, not just the events of it, but also the reaction to it. And like with the news cycle and the images and stuff, it became... A friend of mine was actually just saying to me, he was like, it's not the biggest mass shooting. It's not the first. It's not the last. And for some reason, you know, this is the one that everybody remembers when they heard about it or they remember it. And
it
like
was the instigating.
Yeah.
It was what took, I hate to use words like small, but relatively small in terms of news stories and death count. This sort of fomenting problem. The fact that it wasn't the first is actually part of what made it more powerful. I think Oklahoma City would be etched in our memory. It would be much bigger if there had been a series of small ones before.
Right.
And then it's like, oh my God. But because it was like the first, it was more shocking, but it also made it feel more like a one-off.
Right.
And not necessarily like this is going to be happening every day. But because we've been having several smaller school shootings and America was already very on edge. And then when this sort of went through the roof and with the bombs that didn't go off
in
hundreds and just unthinkable, then it was like, holy shit, like now we're living in a whole, and unfortunately it's inspired all the others.
Right.
And most of them now, you know, we know from their journals and their manifestos.
Right. Like they talk about it.
Yeah. With each other. And they're like, these are, you know, Eric and Dylan are seen sadly as the founding fathers.
Right. Which is horrible. So what Columbine does that is personally, for me, it's my favorite kind of genre of book, which is a truth telling of an event that we think we know, or like a, I don't know, reinvestigation of something that we think that we know. Columbine does it. A book that I love, Blood in the Water, which is about the Attica prison uprising that came out a few years ago. There's other books. There's a book about Oklahoma City bombing that kind of does the same thing. And so what I wonder, I don't want to go too much into the book because I feel like it's been out for 10 years. Go read it. It's amazing. But my question to you is, if you were going to write the Columbine book now, what would you do differently, or what would you change? Or are there things that you know now that you wish you would have been thinking about as you were writing this book? Because you had 10 years from the event, and now you've had another 10 years since the book's come out.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. This is a little hard. Not really. I don't think so. I mean, there are things that now that I would include, and I keep learning more about it, including some of the parts. Yeah, I mean, the part that I really wish there was more, and my editor, my agent, everybody who read it was like, oh, I want more about the killers' families. I was like, I included every...
Right.
Like, tell me about it. Me too. I included every detail I could find. And I was surprised how much I could find from, like, including about the killers. By the way, can I back up with that? The killers, I was so afraid while writing it that I couldn't really bring the killers to life, or I wouldn't have enough information about them. And I kept thinking, like, you know, Capote, of course, sort of stands there towering. Sure. But I'm like, he got to, like, go to Kansas and, like, not just meet the killers.
Like, hang out with
them. Like, he fell in love with one of them. I'm like, he spent, like, I don't know, like, hundreds of hours with them. Like, my guys are dead. Like, I would never meet them. How can I possibly bring them to life? And, like, what is there? I was surprised, like, you know, as I dug and dug, it helped that I took long enough that their journals came out. And I didn't have direct access to their basement tapes, but the people I did, like Agent Fuselet, you know, who's a... amazingly, in this weird case, the first PhD in psychology ever hired by the FBI, happened to have a son in the school and, like, took on the case. And then, like, he spent hundreds of hours with me. It, luckily, he retired from the FBI, so his two hobbies were golf and me. I, that was sort of my take. I would go over to his house for 6 or 7 hours at a time. And I knew when it was just becoming too much, when he would start standing up and doing his imaginary golf swing without even noting it. And I'm like, okay, he's just so just restless. And And his wife, Mimi, would come in with Cokes for, like, the third time and snacks. And but anyway, there was just so much information. Oh, and Dwayne had studied them, Dwayne Fuselet, studied them, like, frame by frame at 2 in the morning. And so, I mean, there was that, but there were, like, their police records. And when they got busted for breaking into the van, you know, of course, they were interviewed separately and they had different accounts, which was very revealing. And like, the cop wrote up like the whole conversation. So I liked those conversations. So I also, I found lots of dialogue from them in these various places. But because of that, also when they were in the, so they were in the diversion program for a year, which is like deferred adjudication is called in some places. They had to see a counselor from the DA's office every 2 weeks. And that person wrote like a paragraph each visit, summarizing the visit. And then for whatever reason, halfway through, that person, their counselor rolled off and another person came on. So you get another person. So you have two persons sort of take on them, and you can see it very changing over time. And also they would use snatches of dialogue from them. Like, so there's a whole file of them, you know, when they went into the program, they had to fill out these forms with all, you know, it was like 8 or 10 pages sort of their parents on them. 1,000 pages of their writings was released.
Oh my God.
So I got IMs that Eric did with different girls. Like, there's so many different pieces, fragments about them. And by the way, I don't talk about this that much, but I broke the book into alternating chapters. It's kind of the before and the after story. But I wrote those separately. And I wrote the after story pretty much chronologically. I tried to. And then problem chapters, I would stop. And the other reasons, chapters that were too painful, I kind of spaced out. But for the most part, I wrote those in order. The after story, Eric and Dylan's story, I took a completely different approach. I did just all Eric, and it took me 5 months. And I just immersed myself in Eric. And every day, I would start my day by either listening to some of his favorite music, like Rammstein or KMFDM, or watching one of the films he loved, reading some of his journal, you know, all of the above, just immersing myself in Eric world. I would write in his voice just as Eric, not to be in the book, but just get in the to get in his head and feel like I could do it. At first it was impossible and I couldn't, and it, you know, seemed all wrong. But gradually I got like, that's how, like, you know a person, like, okay, I know him because, like, I can I can pretend, I can impersonate him pretty convincingly, at least to myself. Like, so that really helped. But anyway, and then I would write scenes with him and sort of trying to infuse his personality onto the page by just taking him inside of me. And obviously Dylan was in a lot, most of those scenes with him. But for the Dylans, I would just like scribble something down or leave, you know, gaps. But I just wouldn't take care of it. It was just like quick and dirty. And so that's why the Dylan part was easier. So then when I finished Eric, I did Dylan. It took me 4 months to do him.
Okay.
And kind of getting in his head and then, you know, filling in the places. I also didn't realize at the time, God, I haven't talked about this in a long time. I got depressed. I didn't realize until I was almost done. Maybe it was when I was done. Oh, I guess I just finished him and we went to see a Harry Potter movie. I can't remember which one. It's one of the latter ones when they were like, Harry and Hermione were on some bridge or something and he makes them go because it's too dangerous for them. And it's all about like, you know, like, all right, he's going to protect his friends.
Right.
Because he's sure that, you know, he's going to get killed. And there's something like, I bring paper in movies, theaters, and I just scribble like crazily. Which, by the way, jumping ahead, the epilogue in Parkland is at a Bruce Springsteen show. Most of the first draft I wrote while at that Bruce Springsteen show.
Wow.
When he brings up the March for Our Lives kids and calls it the March for Our Lives Day. And I just like got choked up like I just did now thinking about it and pulled out of my pocket and just started scribbling and the quotes of what he's saying and writing. And I got home and then like did till like one in the morning, did rewrites of it and sent it and then continued refining. But like, yeah, movies and films and all different things are often inspiration. But I realized, yeah, I forgot about this. With the Harry Potter thing, and then a good friend of mine who's really supportive, when we came out of the Harry Potter film, so much was just coming up. And I just, I'm like, can I just write some more? He's like, take your time. And he just waited for me, like, well, in the lobby, I wrote for another like 40 minutes.
Wow. All this stuff.
But realizing I had just enough distance, something about Harry Potter and the friends relationship, I can't even remember now, made me connect to Eric and his, or Dylan and his friends, and some sort of connection that clicked. And I just had to get it down. But I also realized I've been depressed by, well, it wasn't just depressed. I isolated myself like him and feeling like he felt like isolated from the world. And I kind of did that and became a hermit. And just by, and I felt like, wow, like this sort of excitement of this creativity and getting so much about him made me sort of ecstatic. And I realized how depressed I had been by being out of the depression. And so I could see it suddenly like 5 feet away from it. It's right there. And then I'm like, now I really have to write more of this because I'm like 5 feet away from the depression. I'm still so close and it's so fresh that I can capture it and infuse Dylan's depression into the book with what I just had. But I don't know. I can't write very well while being depressed. But I was like, okay, now is my moment.
Once you got out of it.
Anyway, yeah, but so that was my process with both of those. So that's 9 months together. That was almost a year of doing just
those two.
Those two, but that's the first draft. But it was so the way to go about it because I had to get inside their heads and discovering like, oh, I guess I do know more about these. Yeah, I can say this now because I've talked to Sue Klebold so many times. We sent them an ARC, an advanced copy of the book to them. And they really liked it. And well, I'll just say that Sue talked to me because now I've talked to her many times. They didn't want me talking about this at the time. But before it came out, and I was like, oh, God, I was so afraid. And she said, well, I wouldn't be talking to you if I didn't like it. But she liked it because she's like, you really got Dylan and you got the good and the bad in him. And she's like, obviously, he did this horrible thing, but he was this loving kid, too. And this is many years before she did her book. Like, but she said, yeah, he was like a really sweet kid too. He was very loving. And there were the two parts. And like, you didn't shy away from either of them. And it seemed like an honest portrayal. And like, obviously I didn't know everything about him that they did. But that was, you know, such a relief that, oh God. So your question is what you would have different. I mean, what I would like to do is like add more
about
their
them.
Family and their friends. But that, you know, that was just unavailable.
Right.
But otherwise, you know, there's a few small things. I listened to advice from one person that I wish I had and cut out too much of Patrick Ireland. I wish there was more of him in there. And there's one scene with Linda Sanders that I wish were longer, the original version that cut way back. And so I think as with most things that are cut, it's like when somebody, when an editor or, you know, another good writer friend or whatever, anybody suggesting something being to be cut and you disagree, I've learned this the hard way. And I learned this on the, you know, with the draft of the Gay Soldiers book and really drastically changed something is what's really being said is that, well, if you totally disagree, like you got to follow, your instinct is probably right, but there's something that's not working.
Right.
So you are correct. This needs to be in there, but
you got to find the right way.
Yeah. They think it's cuttable and it's chaff because like you haven't told them why it's important. Or
right.
You haven't made the connection or you haven't made it sing or there's something that's missing there. So like, yeah, it needs to be in there, but you haven't done it yet. And if I can jump in. So the Gay Soldier story, I'm just going to like, minor spoiler. So
it's not even out yet.
I know. So I'm still writing it. But it involves two different soldiers. But this is, I think this will be illustrated about my writing. And I think about the writing process. Two guys who came to know each other, they're friends. They're not, you know, lovers. But they meet about halfway through and become very close. And I meet them about halfway through in the year 2000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I've been following them for 20 years
or
19 years now. So one of them, I open it, I'm just going to tell you, like, I open it on his first day in country, in war, okay. The Iraq war. And it's a harrowing day. That's when IEDs were really bad.
Right.
Obviously, he lives through it. But I'll just say it's a really harrowing first day. And so that's the opening scene. It's a powerful way to open, which, by the way, I was doing it as a piece for the New York Times Magazine, which didn't work out because I took way too long. But a friend of mine who's not even a writer, just a gym friend of mine, and I was telling him, like, you know, I keep figuring out how to, like, get the piece working because, like, the really killer scene is this first day. They call it Route Irish. You know, it's the route from the airport to the green zone. So, like, not even to the green zone.
Right. You're not even, like, checked in.
Yep. Exactly. And, like, that's the killer scene. And I got to figure out how to get to it sooner. I keep, like, adding this stuff to it. He's like, and I can't figure out how to make it, you know, work to get there sooner. And he's like, well, that's a killer scene. Like, why don't you start there? And I was like, yeah, I know, but I can't because blah, blah, blah. And he's like, really? Why can't you? Like, you said it's your best scene. Like, why don't you just start there? And I was like, how did I talk myself into this fact that I couldn't? And that, like, you need to know all this stuff. And I love In Medias Res stuff.
Right.
By the way, I don't even know the story, but, like, when I was talking to one of my great writer friends, Karen Avenen, who's got a great book up there called Look Up Karen.
I'll find it. It'll be in the show notes.
Good, good. I was talking about how much I love In Medias Res opening, she's like, I hope they get this right. There is a Ray Bradbury story that opens, it continued to rain. Which I hope I got that right because I've never read it. But like, but I love that. It's
right.
Like, so like, not just it was writing, like it continued. But anyway, like, you know, the world, like anything, the world was already going on, right?
Right.
Before this began. But so that was a thing. And so now the book is starting there. But for some reason, I'm going to call him Brett because I did this big piece in Salon that got it started that won a GLAAD Media Award. And so we had to change their names and we said so. So I'm going to use still the fake names, Brett. So I felt like Brett's also had to start comparably, like his first day. But I did want to lead up to it. And he was in the Gulf War and leading up to it. And it just wasn't working. It was not nearly as powerful as Drake's. And a really great writer friend of mine read like the first 50 pages. And it starts out with Drake's scene. And then also and his boyfriend, Mark. And then, you know, after maybe 15 or 20 pages, I can't remember, you know, it cuts to Brett. And my friend Billy, he's like, he used to get angry about it. And he's like, oh, I really want to know a Drake story, Drake and Mark Moore. Like, why are you introducing this other guy? And like, and he's like, he's just really pissed off. And he's like, I want this story. He's like, I don't think these other people should be in the book. He's like, why, you know, or you got to introduce them at the beginning. And I'm thinking like, all sorts of books introduce like another major character
right, later,
in another chapter or something.
Right.
It's like, and one of my, you know, Devil in the White City, which I helped, you know, partially basis on, they do about 10, he does about 10 pages in one and then switches to the other. And I was like really back and forth and like, and then suddenly it got to me like, oh, I know what he's telling me that he didn't think he's telling me is like, the second story sucks.
Right.
It's not good enough.
Right. I haven't made it interesting. I haven't made it comparable They're not equal.
And the, actually, the way I realized that is I went back to Devil in the White City. Mm. And I was like, because he starts out with the architect story. Mm-hmm. And the second story is the psychopath. And it's about page 10 or something. I'm like, well, how did he do it on page 10? Like, and I start page 10 is like the first freaking page. It's like this guy, you know, a train pulls into the station in Chicago, smoke coming up, like it steps out. You know, it's already, you can tell there's this feel of like this effer is going to.
Right.
And actually, it hints at, like, you know, all the young women, you know, coming to Chicago and their parents don't know, like, what awaits them. There's a sense of foreboding and immediately, like, he freaking nails it. I'm like,
right.
Oh, if I had nailed it, like, of course, if you flip to this, like, your first reaction was like, oh, it's not Drake, whatever. But in the first paragraph, I just, like, had you sucked in. It's like, oh, he didn't like the second story because it fails. And then I was like, okay, I really want his Gulf War story to have this lead up, and there's so much more to it. And then I realized, you know, after several, you know, a week or two, I'm probably longer wrestling. I was like, again, why did I get in my head that, like, since I opened Drake's story's first day of war, that Brett's has to open the same way.
Right.
In fact, that's kind of boring to do the same thing. And so it actually, now it opens Drake's or Brett's story opens with driving to a gay bar the first time. When he's also a captain, he's a company commander, and he's just figuring out that he's gay. And I will give a little away. They were stationed in Texas, like 100 miles or something from Austin. And he and his buddies, you know, the straight guys, and they're all company commanders. They're all captains. And they go into Austin every weekend, and it's sort of like the playground, this wonderland, and they all love it. And they go to Sixth Street, which anybody who's been to Austin, they call it Dirty Sixth Street.
Right.
So they would go there every weekend, and one night when they're at this, one of his buddies said something about, don't get lost, you know, don't ever get lost, and end up on 4th Street. Like, that's where, like, the, you know, that's where the gays are. And Brett heard that, and in his mind went like, oh. Because I'm going to 4th Street.
Right.
And that was like when he was just starting to admit to himself he might be gay or needed to check it out. And then I think he like planned for like 2 weeks, like, how am I going to make an excuse? Like, he totally like set up, like, during the week, pretended there was like problems in his company so we'd have to stay home. He let them go. Like, in this whole thing, oh, I can't go, I got to work this, you know, let them go, gave him a half hour head start so he wouldn't like run into them on the highway. And then drove up there too and went to the gay bar and then had no idea what. And he had just, this is when Don't Ask, Don't Tell, it was the early years. And it like, in his company, it had to like be there like when there was like a briefing about it. But it also kind of worked to his advantage because he sort of seen this coming. So the JAG officer came to do it. Mm-hmm. Like Brett had to ask a lot of questions on behalf of the company. Like, of course, everybody's like, not asking questions because, of course, soldiers are all acting like, oh, the whole gay thing. Like, you know, nobody's going to ask any questions. They're just, you know, kind of making fun of it. So he had kind of an out where like, okay, I better ask some questions so the guys know the answers. So he was quietly like asking all the things he was wondering and like what you could and could not do. Yeah, I mean, that's just the thing that gay people do when they're coming out to is like kind of telling himself the same time he wasn't doing it for himself, but in retrospect, realizing like, well, that's kind of what I was doing. But anyway, so it starts there with him. But I guess I was telling all that is just like, really, it's like, I grope my way toward things and figuring them out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, can't remember what that is an answer to, but that's kind of my process. I saw on Charlie Rose when the show was really big, years, maybe 10 or more years ago, when they called themselves the Three Amigos, those three great Latino directors, Iñárritu, Alfonso Cuarón, and Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah.
They've been great friends for like 20 years or something, and they help each other with their project. And so Charlie had them on together for the hour. It's a great interview. You should look up. And this is before any of them had won any Oscar.
Right. They all have now, I think.
I think it was after Pan's Labyrinth. Charlie was talking about their process, and what I think Alfonso or Calderon said, well, we're all really different. Like, Guillermo says that, like, he imagines a movie first, knows every frame of it is already pictured in his head, and basically he says his process is just taking the movie in my head and getting it onto celluloid.
Hmm.
It's already there.
Interesting.
And in Iñárritu, if I'm saying it right, is sort of the other end where, like, he's got a vague sense of what he's doing. He sort of fumbles his way there. And Cuarón, sorry if I'm screwing up their names, but I'm terrible with names. I can't believe I've even pulled them all out of my butt. But I love all three of them in different ways. But I love four of them the most. But, okay. but he said, I'm some sort of in the middle.
In the middle.
And I thought, like, yeah, I'm sort of in the middle too. But that has haunted me forever. And thinking, and it took me about a year or two afterwards, like, oh, who am I kidding? I'm a fumbler. Like, I'm like him. Like, I know what I kind of, I know what I wanted to feel like.
Right.
When I'm done, but I don't know.
You don't always know what it is.
I don't ever know, like, really how I'm going to get there and make that happen. I know the effect in sort of, like, what I'm trying to do, but I just got to, like, do it. I keep doing it and, like, working my way toward in so much trial and error. And then, like, and then once it comes, and things tend to come in a rush and in spurts. And, like, oh, and then it's, like, this exhilaration. Like, people ask me to, if you haven't asked, but, like, yeah, like if you love the, I freaking love writing. When it's not, like, torture, like wrestling. I totally, sometimes you feel like wrestling something. It's like a freaking bear I'm trying
right,
to wrestle
right.
for weeks or months. Man, when you get it. And then like also when I'm waking up and yeah, it'll just come to me all these different ideas. My problem is then I don't go back and read them enough and I don't soon. So while I'm here in LA, then I brought like 5 pages of these just like scribbled notes. I fold the paper into quadrants.
Okay.
And so there's like then 8 little sheets okay. on the two sides and I number them as I go. And then can't read it. And like, so I was trying to, I brought them with me and trying to decipher them. Like, what the hell is I'm saying? Sometimes I had to just keep reading like half the page until I can like make something out. And then I remember and then scribbles start making sense.
Right.
Cause I know, cause I remember the conversation.
The context or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
But yeah, but that feeling when it's coming
mm-hmm.
and I feel like that's so exhilarating. That's,
that's the
best feeling
yeah.
in the world.
Oh my God. I love
freaking,
that.
Freaking.
Okay, we're going to switch gears a little bit because we have to get this episode is going to go long. Everybody relax. I'm sitting with Dave Cullen. I don't care what you think at home. Get over it. Okay, so we have this segment called Ask the Stacks where someone's written in and they're going to they ask us for book recommendations. So I'm going to read it and then we're going to come up with some ideas for them.
Cool.
Okay, so this is from Catherine Salant. I think I'm saying that right. Sorry. She says, I've realized that I really love stories of traveling to or living somewhere where you should or could fit in but don't. Particularly around appearance or racial identity. Americana is a prime example of what I love, where she's African and in America, but not African American. Also in Becoming, Michelle's observations when visiting Nairobi, where she says, quote, we were outsiders even with our black skin. And Catherine goes on to say, she mostly reads fiction, but she's open to nonfiction recommendations. So that's what we're kind of looking for, those outsider in a place where maybe they could be inside. I came up with a few ideas, Catherine. All two of them are nonfiction because I like nonfiction. So I came up with a book called The Girl Who Smiled Beads by Clementine I don't know how to say her last name, Wamaria. She was a refugee from Rwanda, and it's her memoir of traveling through Africa as a refugee before she makes it to America. And she was a child with her sister. They were like 8 and 12 or something when this all started. So it's her story of kind of being a stranger in her own country and then throughout Africa. And then the other nonfiction I came up with was Zaytoun by Dave Eggers, where it's after Katrina. It reads like fiction, but it follows this guy Zaytoun as he's trying to like find his home and his family in this like waterlogged New Orleans.
Can I yeah. throw in like one? Yeah. I'm just sort of smiling here. Like, so I lost the LA book prize to him.
Did
for,
you
for that book?
Is that the same year?
Yeah.
Wow.
And in fact, I knew I was going to lose. He was also receiving kind of their lifetime achievement award
okay.
that night. I'm like, oh, great. And then he's nominated in my category. And then, but then here's how stupid I was. So I like decided like I was going to lose. And then I'm sitting in my seat. And then I heard announced Dave. And I like started thinking, oh, my God, I'm forgetting. Like, oh, we have the same name. Like, then, but you know what? My publicist was sitting next to me. And I could see him too. Like, oh, my God. And then like both of us let down. Like, oh, yeah, of course. But anyway, but I mean, who cares? But yeah, that always have a space in my heart. Like, oh, that's the one I lost to. Like,
well, they're both really good books.
Yeah.
I personally, I like yours better, but nobody asked. Okay, the last one I have for you, Catherine, is There There by Tommy Orange. It came out this year. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer. It's about, it's multiple perspective story. It's like 20 or something of all Native Americans in Oakland. So no one's on a reservation. They're just out in the world, and it's their, it's like really high intensity, almost like short stories. I don't know. It's great. It's interesting because it's all these different people who have share this same, you know, identity of being Native American, but it's they vary. And so that would, those would be my suggestions. How about you, Dave?
All right. You know, I did my homework on some of the questions, but I didn't get to that one. And so
That was the first time you're hearing
okay,
that
good,
one.
Okay, good.
Surprise for you.
Okay. So I was trying to, usually, so my thing too is like, it tends to take me a while to figure stuff out. Like when people ask me like, what's my favorite, whatever, like I have to dig my brain, but I came up with like two there. I'm going to screw up the title, but, one is something like, we wish to inform you tomorrow we will be killed along with our families.
All your families. Also Rwanda, right?
Yeah.
I read that.
And yeah, I mean, and it, I'm not sure it completely qualifies, but it does because like if you're a Hutu or a Tutsi. Like,
yeah, you're in the right.
Right. Totally. And by the way, that title.
Is which, major.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, the title comes from like, somebody cabled it, I think, to a priest. That's an actual set. And then they were killed that morning.
Yeah.
The next morning with their families because they didn't get help in time. And the other one might be a stretch, but it also is my favorite book ever.
Okay.
By Vladimir Nabokov. I don't recognize the original title is Conclusive Evidence, which is what I call it. But he renamed it Speak Memory. Yeah, I mean, a lot of his life is, you know, being an emigre and feeling like he didn't fit in and not really understanding the language and trying to be a writer. And then writing in English was very difficult from him. Plus the amazing. It's just extraordinary and
amazing. Okay, so if you guys want recommendations read for you on the air, email askingthestacks@gmail.com. Okay, Dave, we're going to dive into your questions. Let's talk about it. Two books you love and one book you hate.
I love to love hate things. Two I love. Anna Karenina. And by the way, except... you know, it's like over 800 pages. Yes. It took me a year and a half.
No.
And the first 400 pages, by the way, I literally cut it in half.
Really?
Because it's also
too much
like
to carry around.
It's a hold up. Like my neck would crane or my leg.
I got a wrist injury from reading Executioner Song.
Yeah. So I finally just like, you know, I actually asked the internet first, can I just like slice this in half? And people were like, sure. It's like, you know, I took a knife and just sliced it in half down the, and then I'm like, it was so much nicer to just do it in two halves. And then I got a full one too. And I love that on my shelves in my library is like, and I put them next to each other. Like, how come you have two copies of Anna Karenina? And like, one of them seems to be like
falling apart.
but the first half is slow and hard to get through. And you should have cut half of the first half.
Okay.
And then the second half races.
Interesting.
It is so good. I'm like, why couldn't you do that? And you know, I was so happy to see. That you know, so then I got Nabokov has his famous I think it's called Essays on Russian Literature.
Okay,
the name of it. Which he gave as a series of lectures at Cornell when he was a prof there. And half the book there's like 10 of them, and like half the book is Anna Karenina, which he calls the great masterpiece of Russian literature, the best in the history of Russian literature. And I was like, okay, so he's going to tell me why I'm wrong and why I'm all what. I was so happy. No. He says he's got some major problems with it too. And the first half is just like all the stuff. And the same, like when it gets into like, you know, not just serfdom, but like, you know, the serfs and what do you call it? Like the large farms and communism, like just into the minutia of that. Like, why is this supposed to be in here? I'm like, oh, thank you. But you know, I mean, partly the moral of that too is like, you can love something. It can be extraordinary and still have deep flaws, you know, like human beings, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's one of the best books of all time. With some really huge things wrong with it, you know?
Right?
So what?
That's okay.
It's still, it's still fantastic. What and love? Well, Jesus' son. We're going to talk about. Oh, Lucia Berlin, who's also my mentor. But like, I mean, she is the sensation. And I have a Google alert on her. She comes up and like constantly. It's like she's the go-to example now of like. Strong women authors that were missed and like authors that were missed and like she's this like literary sensation now.
Right.
11 years after her death, like no one had heard of her mostly in her lifetime. I did not like find her. Like I happened to like start grad school the same day that she was teaching there, starting teaching there. And she became my mentor and like one of my best friends. She's the first person, not like romantically or a member of my family, who ever told me she loved me.
Oh,
yeah. And gave me permission to say it to other people. My mom died a year and a half ago, but like I only said I love you to my mom the last 20 years of my life because Lucia taught me how. And she would say it all the time. She'd like, she'd giggle. I would make her giggle and she'd be like, I love you, darling.
Aww.
And I know, just so effortlessly. And I was like, oh, I love you. Just like, because you do. You know, like, it's like, that's just like, oh, you know, who else? Like gay people, the gay guys also around, like, you know, say it to each other.
Right.
You know, and you don't like, because we do. It was like, and Latinos. I was in Denver. I had so many gay Latino friends. And they're just like, they also taught me like to be affectionate. Like, you know, not a cold, distant white guy.
That's so beautiful.
I know that's what I love so much about them too. It's like, oh, okay. Because they do, you know. And it's nice to just like know that there are people that, you know, love you. It's nice, good, useful to hear.
Yeah.
In fact, I've had some straight guys who say, tell me, like, that's the thing that I admire most, who have a lot of gay friends, that I admire most about you guys, that you can, like, connect with your other male friends that way. And like, the spoken things instead of, like, you know, instead of the unspoken thing that, like, oh, my buddies know that. But, like, it's freaking nice to hear it. Like, it's like nurture. It helps your soul, you know, to know, like, especially in your dark moments. That, you know, I know some people love me, and I know because told me like in the last week, you know?
Right.
What I hate, God, so many, but God, which one do I want to single out? Like,
who do I want to throw under the bus?
I know. Well, since you said it, actually, I hated the Executioner song, although I didn't finish it. I don't know, something about like the clip sentences, though, I got accused of that, but like, I don't know. I don't like the voice of it.
No, I'm with you. I pushed through because I thought I was going to be, I thought it was something that it wasn't, because if you, as someone who loves true crime, I spent a lot of time Googling best true crime books, and a lot of them are really good.
List. Yeah,
Your book is on it. Helter Skelter, which is one of my favorites. Truman Capote, In Cold Blood is on there, another book I love. And I knew Executioner Song was something that I had to get to. And my friend in New York had a copy and told me to read it. And I was like, okay, finally. And last year I got to my reading goal really early. So I was like, I could read 1,100 pages. Like, who cares? And just not a lot happens.
I know.
Like, the crime part is very small. And then it's just a lot of, like, angsty white guy.
Really? And it's like 800 or 1,000 pages.
It's 1,100 pages.
Yeah, okay.
1,147.
That was the other thing. I think I got 100 some pages into it. So, okay, so I'm saying this without having finished. You know, Hemingway all said to something like, when somebody's like, well, how do you know if you didn't finish? He had, obviously I'm bastardizing this quote from like, but he's like, when you eat an omelet with rotten eggs, you don't have to eat the whole thing to know.
Right, exactly. You know in your heart if you don't like something.
It's not getting any better.
And it doesn't, and I always say, like, just because I don't like it doesn't mean that it's bad. It just means that I don't like it.
Exactly.
Like, I don't eat omelets because I don't like eggs.
Yep.
I'm not saying that eggs are bad. I don't like them. Which is like, I get annoyed when people are like, you don't like eggs? I'm like, more eggs for you. Leave me alone. Right,
there's a lot of things in the world.
For those of you who love Executioner Song, more Executioner Song for you, for us.
And I get it that sometimes it's the wrong time for you.
Yes, that's another part of reading.
You know, with Nabokov, when I read Conclusive Evidence, which, by the way, the title, you know what the title refers to?
Mm-mm.
Conclusive Evidence of My Having Existed.
Hmm.
And it's kind of his autobiography. And
interesting.
I'm like, oh, that's such a writer thing, too. It's like, this is going to be the mark I leave on the world. This is going to be what I do and how I impact this planet. Also, because I can't stop myself from writing, but also I want like some conclusive evidence that I have existed.
Right, that you existed. Oh my God.
I called my blog that. And like, I started a blog back in 2001 or something, and I had it for many years. I called it Conclusive Evidence of Dave Cullen's Having Existed.
I love that. Okay, let's talk about, what are you reading currently?
Well, as usual, I'm, you know, doing two things at once. So in my hotel room, they have like two books that you can like take with you, and then the $16 is donated to charity. And one of them was The Handmaid's Tale, which I always thought I should try this. So I read like two pages of it, well, plus a little of her introduction, which I tend to hate introductions. But when the introductions, because like who fucking, like, I, you know, I just, right. sorry, I just want to get into it. But like when the introduction, her backstory was really interesting. Mm. And I was like, really? I'm like, oh. And then I flipped to it. I only got like two pages into it, like freaking great from like the first couple pages. By the way, can I toss another one? Probably in my top 10 favorite books, but I would consider possibly the most flawless book I've ever written, read. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm.
I don't think there's this, there's not like a spare word or sentence in the book. It is just, there's not a mistake. And it is just like, is tight. I saw the movie first.
Okay.
Nurse Ratched. And like now it's like the 70s, but it like won all the Oscars of like Jack Nicholson. Right, probably the most famous. And Louise Fletcher is Nurse Ratched. So she won the Oscar for Best Actress for Nurse Ratched for just being amazing.
Right.
It's cold.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, terrifying. Like over the course of the movie, I had seen that first, and I was sort of really curious, like, you know, how much of the book, you know, will it take to really establish her, the first page of her? And the way he did it, too, is, by the way, the Indian, what is his name? The chief, I guess they called him the chief.
Yeah.
He's in the movie, but he's the narrator of the book.
Right.
And it's one of the classic unreliable narrators.
Right.
Because he's freaking certifiable, and he's telling you this story.
Right.
So at some point, and... So the first scene of her is Chief Broom, I think that's his name, you know, saying like, you know, it's morning and like, you know, the guys are here, the orderlies or whatever. And like they pull back the wall where basically there's all this machinery with her brain. She's controlling like all this machinery and like, my, you know, it's all physical stuff happening. Like he's got this very involved scene. So you know he's unreliable from the first
thing.
He freaking thinks this is real. And she's like, but I mean, he uses that metaphor and somebody thinking it's true of like her control she has over this place. And like in like a couple of paragraphs, you get like, oh my God, everything that Louise Fletcher did in that movie, it's like, let's see, like on the first page. And like every page of that thing is, it's a short book, maybe 200 pages and it's just really every step of the way. Anyway, there's that, and I can't remember. So Handmaid's Tale. So I'm two pages in and freaking loving it. but I'm also actually only about five pages into Chronic City by Jonathan Latham, which I'm loving because I just finally read the book that everyone's supposed to have read, Motherless Brooklyn, which won a zillion awards. And like, I've never read Latham. I think it's one of the great books written in my lifetime. It is just... well, the one we're going to talk about, Jesus' Son, Jennifer Egan's
Goon Squad.
From the Goon Squad. And this are kind of my three favorites. I guess they're written in my adult lifetime,
yes.
over the last 25 years. And I just started in Chronic Cities. His ability to describe and just grasp and convey just amazing things about people or situations sort of connect them. He's extraordinary. There's a brilliance there that you get on every page that I'm. God, I guess I just realized I used to be incredibly intimidated by authors like that. When I would read Nabokov, it would really set me back as like, I can never be this good. I can never do this what he does. And now I'm finally getting like I'm good at what I do, and I like pieces of this, but I'm not going to be that guy. Like I don't have to be that guy. But it's a little intimidating. But God, I think that's actually the first book. Ever maybe by I was wowed by that much that I really didn't. There was sort of like background feelings of like just little flutters of minor intimidation in the background where I didn't feel like every page of like, oh my God, every brilliant thing was a double-edged sword of like, this is amazing and I'm unworthy. Like, I actually didn't. I literally think this is the first time I ever experienced where I guess I got comfortable enough with my own stuff. I think, by the way, that a big part of that. He's having a second book.
Mm.
For some reason, the whole imposter syndrome thing has become a thing lately. I've had that for a long time. And partly, you know, I didn't publish my first book until I was like my late 40s. And I was like, oh, I want to write books, but like, I don't actually have a book. and then for a while, you know, 10 years to do the second book, you know, when people ask, you know, oh, what kind of writing do you do? Because I say I'm a writer when people ask. And oh, what do you do? I'm like, well, books mainly. And that started to feel more and more like, not a lie, but like, I don't know, a little like making that plural, like mm-hmm. books, except, well, book mainly. Like,
yeah, yeah.
I actually only have the one. Or they ask like, oh, what are some of your books? I'm like, well, I only have the one.
Right.
But also, you know, sophomore syndrome has always, and I think even since I was like in college, you know, it happens with so many bands.
Right,
and,
right.
And being very aware of, I think artists of any form, there's a fear of failure. There's a lot of things. There's a lot of pressure. Your second attempt of anything when the first one is hit either critically or commercially, and Columbine was both.
Okay.
You know, it was a bestseller and won a bunch of awards. And,
right.
And yeah, I also got, like, I don't have to be modest, but like, I can just, like, those are just, like, facts. But
right. No need to be modest here. You should toot your own horn. My God, it's an amazing book.
Yeah, but like, but yeah, I believe in the whole false modesty thing. Like,
right.
It was a hit. It's like, so sophomore syndrome hanging over my head for, mm-hmm. for 10 years. And I think, and especially since then, spending 10 years on the second book, but then having 9 years and then having to, the Gay Soldiers book and having to step aside and do this other one, insert it, like,
right.
in and write it in like,
so
record
quick.
And write it in 10 months.
Right.
And just, yeah, I wrote most of it in about 3 months.
Wow.
And just turn it out. And then fearing like, and I remember having this conversation with my agent Betsy in the spring of like, if I should do this, I'm like, will I be able to do a really good book like in the next 6 months? Will that hurt my career? If like, not even a shitty book. What if it's a mediocre book? Is like, should I, you know, do this sort of race book, not on race, but race
right.
writing. And then I need to write this book and I just need to do it and be damned, like whatever things. But it's given me confidence in a different kind of way that I can make this happen very quickly. And then I can have material I like too. And, and I can do a second one. I can do this again. And now it really helps that I've almost done 3 books, you know, and I'm like, okay, I do know how to do this. And it really has helped sort of crystallize things about that third book in the process too. So I think there is maybe a different confidence because although this book came out, it hit the New York Times bestseller list, and a lot of people love it. I'm getting wonderful feedback on it. So and it's a completely different kind
so
of
different.
Book. It's
so different.
It's such a different and actually there's a lot of confusion because of the titles, and we should have put the subtitle maybe on the cover, but
But the cover, it would be messy. People can open the book. Don't worry about it. Okay,
but so I have a different kind of confidence. So go on.
We're going to do a few more questions. Okay, We've really gone over, but I just don't care. I'm sorry.
I'll try to do short answers.
Yes, we're going to do, I'm only going to ask you 3 more. So
okay, I'll try to do the quick version.
So question number 1 of 3 is, who are some authors that you look to or admire or who inspire you, either just for their writing, but also maybe like towards in the direction of what you do, the kind of writing you do.
Well, I mean, somebody else already mentioned all the Russians. Weirdly, I don't understand why. Like, you know, if you'd meet me of like 19th century czarist Russia, would be like the last kind of people I would feel this weird connection with. But like, you know, Nabokov, Chekhov. Now I'm getting into Tolstoy. Who's the one who wrote? Notes from Underground and the brothers
Karamazov's novel.
Yeah, him, Dostoevsky.
Yes.
I don't know why this is a fact. But Lucia Berlin, who mentored me and taught me so much. And I want to do a lot of the candor and the honesty that she has, and Dennis Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Although I don't always love all of his books, some of the situations don't completely work for me, but his style is like, my friend who I mentioned, Bill Lyshack, he's just this amazing. People have insights about the world and in their writing. You know, Jennifer Egan and Jonathan Latham. Definitely those are some of them. There's a guy called Barry Yargrau who wrote Wearing Dad's Head, which is kind of amazing. It's these little vignettes and that one is literal. A kid. all these kinds of ones they're amazing little. I take different things from different people, but Faulkner. I also spent my whole life, you know, these lists of people, also feeling this guilt of like great authors I've never read. By the way, I'll turn some people off here. Also out of ignorance, I've never read a Dickens novel. The idea of Dickens has always turned me off, and I have tried so many times, and everything about them turns me off.
That's okay.
I know. And it's like, okay, I can read this stuff, but like, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to, I don't like anything about what he's doing. It, and I always thought like a Faulkner that like, oh, I'm not going to like that. And then I was like, oh my God, like Southern Gothic, right, or whatever. Like, oh, that sounds like awful to me. And, you know, and I lived in the South several times. I lived in Georgia and North Florida, what, you know, Texas. And As I Lay Dying was also the first one I read and drove me nuts. So this is sort of like the example of why you should stick with things longer, because it was driving me mad. Because, you know, like, he doesn't tell you that he keeps changing the narrator for the first couple of chapters.
I've never
like,
read it.
Oh, each chapter from a different person's point of view. Mm. Like, you flip to chapter two. There's short, I don't know, 3 to 5 page chapters, and you get to page six, and it's like, the voice is different. Everything's different. Like, what? It doesn't make any sense. Like, oh. And the early chapters are, the chapter title is the name, person's name. But still, okay, so that you know that, you have to figure that out for yourself. But that's not that hard to figure out. Constantly in that book, you do not know what the hell is going on. But it took, and it was driving me crazy for, I think, 25 pages or something until it suddenly clicked. Every time I'm totally confused and don't know what the hell's going on, give it a page or two and it will all fall into place. And you'll know. So just sort of suspend and keep reading. And not only like, so that sounds like kind of a gimmick, right? It's not a gimmick.
Right.
You are much richer for not having known, because you didn't know, neither did the person who was telling the story.
Right.
Not understanding what was going on. There's like a lot of, it's a family and right, a lot of stuff going on. And you're getting his or her perspective that's completely in the dark. And then when it clicks, because then you're getting the other person like, wow. And like, you felt like.
Right. What you that had to work felt through it too.
That helped me with Columbine, by the way. I was reading that while writing Columbine.
Oh, wow.
And deciding how many protagonists and like toying with the idea of having 10 protagonists.
Right.
Not just 10 main characters, but each one is sort of protagonist.
Right.
And 10 little clusters of people.
Right.
A whole little, you know, supporting cast. And thinking, can I do that? And then it's like, he's got like a dozen, not just protagonists, like narrators. Like,
right.
And I was sort of like, if he can pull that off, that's much harder. Like,
much harder.
Okay, I can do this. But like, and his stuff is so different from what I do, but also because sort of like descriptors and like, there's, yeah, I'm pulling different pieces. Like, you probably never see any, you might read all of Faulkner's stuff and never see any connection to me, but there's certain things that,
right,
that are in common and that I'm pulling and that I'm perfecting. It's all like, well, it is with me here. So I put Fizz, P-H-Y-S, in the margin. Anyway, Fizz in the margin because I used to not know how to describe people.
Mm-hmm.
Or, well, or do that, you know, little thumbnail sketch.
Mm-hmm.
I don't describe people naturally. I just, I'm all about what's going on, what's happening,
right,
the plot and the character, and not like, what do they look like? I don't freaking care. So I had to learn to just insert that because other people did. And in writing school, people were like, I don't even know what he looks like, or, you know.
Right.
So I always felt like I was doing that awkwardly. So I set about to just learn how people did that. And so I still do for practice. Every single book, when they describe a character, I just mark in the margin where it's happening. But P-H-Y-S, short for physical description. Just by doing that, it helps me sort of like notice and like... a couple of the reviews of Columbine, one in particular, I can't remember who it was, said, Columbine really has a knack for the thumbnail description. And then some people did on Parkland too. I was like, oh, I learned how to do that.
Yeah.
Like where somebody's actually like complimenting me. My goal was to get up to an acceptable level of doing
right,
it. I just want to be not shitty at that. Because one of my favorite Elvis Costello lines, don't want to be first, I just want to pass.
Right.
And that's just what I wanted to be, make that passable. And because then I studied so hard on it for 20 years because I was so terrible at it. Like, oh, I'm actually pretty good at it. But it still doesn't completely come natural to me. But now I love doing it, though. It's selecting, you know. And I remember learning from Janet Burway, by the way, who wrote the great book on writing called Writing Fiction, mm-hmm, I think, A Guide to Narrative Craft, The Telling Detail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she talks about how, like, some writer, you know, or young writers, and you see this in writing school, you know, especially with undergrad, it's like, you know, every stupid person who enters, they describe them like, you know, the barista at Starbucks. And like,
right,
you know, you get like her outfit, like her character. Like, we don't need to know what we've got. Right. Plus a list of things.
I
like,
hate
you know,
that.
Yeah. But it's like the telling thing. Like, but now that's like such a puzzle. Like, okay, if I was going to tell like one or two, three things about this person, and what's going to think that nails them? Like, And I have certain touchstones I remember, like Anne Waldman. The joke is she's never been seen in public without a scarf. Like, she's like this
affectation.
She's like, like picture a drag queen with a boa. It's
like a
drag woman's version. And, you know, and to the point, like, you know, the joke is like, it's covering up where, you know, her head is stitched on, you know,
stitched on
her neck or something. And her head would fall off if it were not. But she could never be seen without a boa. I was just telling a guy, too, at the gym. It's like, because he's writing a story about testosterone and a guy's bulking up. And I'm like, you know, he wanted some pointers. I'm like, you know, it's descriptors. Like if I were describing some guy, I'd be like, you know, the whole thing about the guys who cut their shirts off, you know, into like a tank top, but like cut it just far enough so like it just barely covers your nipple.
Right.
Except enough that like doing certain sets of like nipple pop out.
Right.
And like there's this weird thing of like in the gym, like for a man, it's like immodest, like you don't know. And then like the really slutty guys who like cut it where the nipples aren't.
Right.
But, like, that is like a thing, and like, you know,
and that like means something.
Yeah. And if that guy was doing it, like, you can tell a lot about his character by how he cuts his shirt. Like, that would be my telling detail I would use for that guy. But so it, and I was just doing that off the top of my head, but I was like, really? Yeah. If I were at the gym too, it's like, that I'm going to like pull out that you're going to remember about them too.
Right. And that can help you imagine it as the reader.
Yeah.
Or imagine that person.
Yeah, and I think I let what okay, should I do those really quick. What was the other parts of that question?
No, that was it.
Okay.
I think. I don't even remember.
I think I skipped part of it, but I know.
It's okay. Okay, short. I have two more. This one you have to do short because the last one I really want to get to.
Sorry.
This one is obviously your brain moves very fast, which I love.
Jumping
which
around.
I relate to you. I can spin out, like, about, I can talk about anything, you know. How do you like to read? Like, how can you kind of like, because I feel like if I'm really up on something or like feeling all the vibes, it's hard for me to read because it takes, like, I have to be in the right spot to kind of like come down and focus on someone else's story. So what's your setup for reading? Like, what's your ideal reading setup?
A really comfy chair.
Okay.
I can't be too tired because then I fall asleep.
Me too.
And I can't do it for too long because I'll fall asleep. But with a pen in my hand, I try to stop myself, but I underline and put a check mark of things I like, and I write all sorts of margin notes and sometimes arguments with myself in there. So I have to be kind of engaged.
Okay.
And I think, you know, I was starting to think as I said that to you of like, I fall asleep. I'm like, no, I don't. I used to. Like, oh, since I started like using a pen,
right.
I have to be kind of an active part of the process with it. Yeah, because if it's too sedentary and like just sitting there, then I fall asleep. But I got a new couch recently.
Mm-hmm.
Freaking love it. And so I can just get really cozy in there. But, and it has to be a place that I like, I don't do other work or other sorts of things. And really the only thing I do, and it's not a couch, it's actually a love seat because my Hell's Kitchen apartment, there isn't room for a couch.
A
two-seater is like as wide as the living room will accommodate. Sometimes I'll watch TV there, but usually not even, usually I watch TV in the kitchen while cooking and doing stuff. But so it's mainly, it's almost my reading couch. And like I have learned, it helps if it's like actually facing in a different direction. And so I'm like, I've got a different visual and like different than I do other things. I like it to sort of like be its own world that's like different from all the other, you know, even, so it puts me in a slightly different headspace. So,
Okay. And then here's the last one. I stole this from the New York Times book review. I love it.
The book thing?
Yeah, the buy the book, exactly. If you could recommend one book to the current president of the United States, what would it be?
Well, and the Constitution doesn't count because I think he's...
I swear to you, that is the number one answer that people say. The Constitution, every time, I'm like, yeah, we get it. He doesn't know that. Yeah.
Okay, sorry, that just like, came to me.
But yeah, he should read that. That would be a good place.
I hate to keep going back to the well too, but I would have him read Lucia Berlin's A Manual for Cleaning Women. Which is short stories, mostly of working class women, of worlds that I think he's completely unaware of, like riding the bus in, in Oakland in shitty neighborhoods, you know, trying to find enough dimes, you know, to pay their fare, switchboards when that was a thing. It's like a lot of people who probably work for him.
Right.
And he has sort of no awareness of their lives and no, you know, sense of, riding around his helicopter. By the way, let me back up to one of the smartest things Lucia ever said to me Chekhov was her sort of favorite person she aspired to, and especially his sort of was respect for everybody and lack of judgment about everybody. Mm-hmm. I remember her saying to me that he will treat a princess and a chambermaid, you know, with exactly the same kind of respect and lack of judgment. And then she waited a beat for that to sink in, and she said, "I know you got you just took exactly the wrong moral from that." And yeah, you know, I know what you took from that was he should treat the chambermaid with as much respect as the princess. That was easy for you to get because you would too, because you would disdain the princess and you would be making fun of her. Mm-hmm. Your challenge is to treat the princess also with as much compassion and as a chambermaid, because she's a person too.
Right.
And I mean, Trump doesn't have that problem. He would need to do it with the maid.
Right.
But we're all different. And wherever you're coming at
right.
it, you know, wherever you come out of that equation, because I do have disdain for royalty and princes
right.
and princesses. And
right.
I refer to the that unemployed woman in England.
Right.
You know, and like when there was a pregnancy, right. I tweeted like, oh, that unemployed woman in England is pregnant now. I mean, that's what the freaking Windsors are to me. But they're human beings too, and they're trying and they're doing something. And so, you know, so I'm sort of bitchy about it. But like, I guess that's the thing is like, I can be bitchy about the Windsors and hate Watch the Crown. Mm-hmm. And like my friends are like, and a lot of other stuff, and Victoria. But if I were to write about the Windsors or royalties, I would have to let that go.
Right.
And treat them. And I think that's what we forget, that it's very easy to sort of like be like, oh yeah, other, without knowing it, they're like, oh yeah, other people's like, oh, they're not giving, you know, the chambermaid is like,
right.
I would be interviewing, you know, the maid and, you know, fascinated by them. Like, that's easy for me to respect her.
Right, right.
And like, I don't think she's an idiot. She may well be uneducated because like where she came from, she had no
right.
chance, but like, she could be like a Rhodes Scholar
right,
who never got
course.
A chance to go past third grade, or maybe she did, you know, but,
right.
but anyway, but I'm fascinated to find out. I don't have a problem with that, but I do. But we all have a problem with somebody. And that's the thing, too. And she's like, she's really cracked it. We're like, she respects everybody in
right,
the stories.
Right.
Whether she would love them or hate them in real life.
Right.
She's not judging them when they're the characters.
Hmm.
And that's what and Chekhov didn't either.
Right.
And I think she totally exceeded him, you know. Hmm. And you know, that would have sounded ridiculous 20 years ago. Now that she's like, the New York Times has called her a genius more than one occasion. Like, I really think she did
right.
further than he did, too. And with more people, I don't know that Chekhov knew. I mean, I don't know. I don't actually know his bio. I don't know if he was, like, really getting those working class people as well, or if he was, you know, sort of making them up and not really knowing what he's talking about. I don't know. But I know Lucia did all those jobs.
Right.
He was an alcoholic forever. And, you know, had her three husbands, I think, at least one alcoholic and two drug addicts and, you know, lived in that world. But yeah, Trump would, of course he wouldn't, but if he
right.
got these stories and like took them to heart. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess that's implied in the question.
Right.
Read the book and like, you know, really
right.
went
and
there
like,
with it.
Paid attention.
Yeah.
right.
Exactly. Yeah. I think he could, you know, do for meeting some other people in America.
I love that. Okay. So we're going to sign off today. We're going to be back next week. We're reading Jesus's Son by Dennis Johnson. Read it. It's super short. You can read it in like a day. That's what I did. And we'll be back next week with Dave Cullen. But for now, Dave, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much.
And we'll see you guys in the stacks. All right, that does it for us today on The Stacks. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you to Dave Cullen for joining us. Dave will be back next Wednesday to discuss Jesus's Son by Dennis Johnson. Also, I wanted to say a special thank you to Leslie Cohen at HarperCollins for helping us set up this interview. Everything we talk about on today's show can be found in the show notes, along with links to all of our social media accounts. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at TheStacksPod and on Twitter at TheStacksPod_, or check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Get your book recommendations read on air by emailing askingthestacks@gmail.com. And to join the Stacks Pack, get inside access to this show and more, go to patreon.com/thestacks.
thanks to Audible, listeners of this podcast get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download by going to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review the show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCright, and our theme music is from Tagirigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas. I will see you in the stacks.